Hi, it's Ari Krug. Welcome back to Mind Your Body. I am excited to share today this episode that I did with my former coworker and good friend, Dr. Renee Ortega. We worked together at a therapeutic preschool with children from 3 to 5 years old who were on the spectrum, as well as diagnosed with oppositional defiant disorder, ADHD, and a range of other diagnoses, but a lot of these kids had experienced trauma. And so we get into conversation about how does dance therapy help them? And before I do this episode, I really want to read to you this note that I wrote from a session that I did way back when. Let's see, it's from July 31st, 2013. And that is about 4 months after I started my first job as a dance therapist at this preschool. I go through my notes often and I kind of delete the old stuff and decide what's worth keeping and what I can kind of, let go of. And I just can't seem to let go of this note because it was just such an amazing session with these children. So I'm going to read it to you because I feel like this is the essence of doing dance therapy with children who are vulnerable and scared and learning how to regulate themselves in a world where life hasn't been fair and full of hurt. All right, so here we go. I just had the perfect session with a group of children who are all graduating. As important as termination is, I have decided to let it naturally work itself out. Today, I gave them a very loosely structured directive to take turns moving on a fabric that can be anything they want to be. Some kids built a house, some destructed it, and the last child grew flowers. With my suggestion, this turned into all of us growing into trees as the teachers planted and watered the seeds on the kids. They were apple trees, grape trees, etc., very generous with sharing fruit. One child came to me, all concerned, saying, a child ate all my fruit. They said the name, I just wrote a child. So-and-so ate all my fruit. So he sunk back to the floor, becoming a baby tree again, needing more nurturing to grow fruit again. This spread through the class and the kid trees needed much planting and watering as they kept going back to be a baby tree. One kid was even stunted in his tree growth. This went on for a while. By the last 5 minutes, we all became baby sleepy trees and cuddled together on the fabric. It was a beautiful ending. The session seemed to be so symbolic of their leaving. These kids have been growing at the school for the past 2 years, and now they have to leave to go to kindergarten. But perhaps they would rather just be babies again, so they don't have to leave. There's conflict between wanting to grow and showing off how much they have known, how much they have learned, against wanting to be young and dependent and taken care of. It's very healthy for these kids to play out these feelings and conflicts before they leave, and that is just what they were doing. I just got chills just remembering that session. So anyway, I don't know if that made sense because I have this amazing picture in my head of what it was like and how it all happened. And whether, if you're a dance therapist, you may very well have just a clear visual of this. If you're not, you might be like, what? I don't understand. I don't know. But I thought I'd share that with you. I don't think I'll ever delete that note. So one more thing before we go into the interview with Renee, I just wanted to share with you that I finally created a low-cost program to work with me. It's been a while, and I know you've been asking me for a while. It's a membership program called the Lasting Love Sisterhood, where you get to shed old layers of protection and hurt and abandonment and emerge into the truest version of yourself, so that you can truly thrive and enjoy the relationship with yourself and everyone else in your life. I will put the link in the show notes, but you can also visit orietkrug.com/sisterhood for a lot more details. All right, here we go.
This is Mind Your Body, a dance movement therapy perspective on the integration of our emotional, cognitive, physical, and spiritual aspects of our being into one more aware and whole existence.
Yeah, welcome back, everybody. Welcome back to Mind Your Body. I am really excited today to bring on our guest to talk about dance movement therapy with children who have experienced trauma. We've got Renee here. Welcome, Renee.
Hello.
I'm going to introduce you quickly. So Dr. Renee Ortega is a board certified dance movement therapist and licensed creative arts therapist. In addition, she's a certified occupational therapy practitioner. Renee is a researcher looking at healthcare professionals, intercultural competency. Her PhD is in international psychology with a trauma concentration. During COVID, she has utilized these principles of these professions and her BFA in dance to manage self-care, well-being, and connection through daily dancing to connect mind, body, and soul. So yeah, welcome Renee. I'm excited to have you here. I basically just reached out this week after continuing to get messages from my community in the Lasting Love Movement, which is, you know, has women in there who have experienced trauma themselves. They've also started to ask me, well, you know, my children have experienced trauma with me or my siblings. And so I've been getting a lot of questions of like, does dance therapy work for children as well? So I was like, all right, who am I going to reach out to? Renee and I worked together for several years working with children,
yes.
Ages 3 to 5 at the League preschool, lots of children who were experiencing trauma, and you're still there. So maybe you can give us a background of what dance therapy looks like. Well, what dance therapy looks like with these children who have experienced trauma, like what is happening for them and then how do you work with them?
Well, I think, first of all, thank you for having me. I'm so excited to have this conversation with you. And I love any opportunity to talk more and go deeper into dance movement therapy, working with children, all of those things. So I would say for starters, dance movement therapy to me is even more powerful when you're working with a pediatric population or with children, because children don't have the verbal language, the sophisticated verbal language to express themselves. So I have found in my experience that they're so much more attuned, that they're so much more connected to communicating nonverbally, especially younger children who are under 10, because they're still so connected and so close to using movement as their primary way of getting their needs met, right? So how do we know that babies are hungry or that they're sad or that they're tired or that they're irritable or that they're sick, right? Through their nonverbal communication. So to me, we as adults actually foster and reinforce this connection or need to use verbal language. And if we don't do that, children would continue to use their nonverbal expression to have their needs met. So I think it is a unique opportunity to be able to connect with them in their primary language, which is nonverbal, you know? And in my experience of working with children, I find that you get to see the variations of their relatedness, of their personalities in the movement experience. I think this is even more so true for children who don't have age level language or sophisticated verbal communication. Also for children who may have receptive understanding, so they can receive the information, they can see, receive the verbal information, but their expressive language may be limited. So to me, movement becomes a great way to really connect with them through a social emotional space. It is also a great way to assess or really see if they're demonstrating signs of trauma in terms of how they're relating.
On that, like, how would you see that they're showing signs of trauma that, you know, they can't necessarily verbalize, but you can see it and even they can feel it in their own bodies?
So a perfect example, I would say, especially considering the population that I have primarily worked with across the 17 years of my career as a therapist working with children, has been primarily children with behavior issues, primarily children with trauma backgrounds. So when you're working with children that may be displaying aggressive behavior, so maybe they're hitting, they're kicking, they're punching, they're spitting, you know, the primary goal is safety, the safety of the child, the safety of yourself. So your first instinct may be to restrain that child or to restrict that child in terms of their movement or their expression for their safety and for the safety of anyone around them. You may move things in the space, whatever you need to do. However, in my experience for children who have different types of trauma, you may go to restrain them and they may get even more aggressive and they may get even more distressed. And in my experience, that has been a rapid indicator that this child has had some type of extreme trauma, and actually our attempts to remind them that they're safe, right? Because what are some of the things that we do to kind of remind people that they're safe? We give them deep touch. We give them deep pressure. We try to connect with them so that they kind of see and understand, like, I'm here with you. I'm in this space with you. I'm in this moment with you. So many times in dance movement therapy, we try to mirror back movement. We try to mirror back expression. But with someone who has trauma, they may not be able to handle that level of reflection. They may not be able to stay or coexist in that space with you. And in my experience, those are usually children who have the most trauma. And so we have had to become more creative in how we address this aggressive behavior or this not safe behavior that they may be displaying. And so in those instances, we may have to make sure we remove everyone and everything out of the space, because being in relationship to them physically is more than that they can handle. Like, they're an overload.
Mm-hmm. So what does that look like in a dance therapy session specifically? Because I imagine you're talking about like the entire kind of container of the school setting that you're working in.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. What about the container of a dance therapy session? How do you help them express themselves? How do you help them find and use the language to mm-hmm. express their emotions, to regulate, to basically help them almost kind of function as a kid who can get through the school day, right? Who can get through social interactions without becoming aggressive and so on.
Mm-hmm. So I think that we have to think about, not only when working with children, but also with working with adults, I think there are a lot of parallels. So if we consider the idea that emotions work in a range, we're not happy all the time, we're not sad all the time, we go through a range of emotions and experiences throughout the day, right? So I wake up, I'm energized, I have lots of energy, I'm happy. As the day progresses, maybe I'm feeling tired, now I need a little nap, you know, but maybe I went for a walk, maybe I got my coffee, maybe I had an engaging conversation, so now my energy is back up and now I feel invigorated, you know. But maybe I get a phone call and something happens and now I'm feeling sad and I'm feeling overwhelmed. So we go through a range of emotions. And so I think the work for us in a dance therapy session is getting a child to a point where they recognize that they can have a range of emotions. so that they don't have to stay in that place of anger or trauma. They don't have to stay in that place of being sad. And they also don't have to stay in a place of always being happy and content, right? Because there is a range. Mm-hmm. And I have had dance movement therapy sessions with children where they can literally go through a range of 5 emotions within that 30-minute session, right? And so the work for us is, how do we hold a safe space for that? Mm-hmm. And so I think if a child, like a perfect example that comes to mind, are children who may really want to express themselves, but they're so withdrawn for whatever reason, whether they're like just typically shy, whether that's trauma, you know, whether that's behavioral. And one approach could be like, okay, you know, especially when you're first starting out and you're working on building a rapport, it's like, okay, you don't want to be seen right now. Like, I'm not going to see you. I'll check in with you to see if you might be ready to engage, to share, to, you know, interact. But as the relationship progresses and you kind of say, okay, well, that approach is not working, right? That child is never getting to a place where they're ready to be seen. Then you have to kind of say, what happens if I show them that I see them, but in a way that's comfortable for them, in a way that's not necessarily putting the whole spotlight on them, but it is saying like, I do see you for whatever you're bringing to this session, to this moment. And so I've had moments where a child is like, you know, like, I don't want to participate, and their head's down and they're withdrawn. And, you know, it's like, and maybe they do one slight gesture, because again, children don't understand the range. Right? So they're either all the way up or they're all the way down. They find it hard to modulate and regulate and stay in that middle place, right? So when you're in a session with children and you say, oh, it's your turn to dance, or it's your turn to express yourself, their understanding or comprehension of that is usually very big. It's big, it's loud, it's abundant, right? And so now here you have this child that's more like, I don't want to be that big. I don't want to be that abundant, right? And so they may do one thing, like maybe they're here and they may just move their hand. And that is the moment that I take. That is the moment where I say, oh, you know what? You do want me to see you, Ori. I noticed that you moved your finger a little bit. It is also a teachable moment for the other children and adults to say, you know, we don't always have to be big. Sometimes we want to be seen, but we want to be small, or we want to be quiet, or we want to be soft. And so to me, that is the teachable moment for the group. That is a teachable moment for the children. It's also a subtle mirroring, right? Mm-hmm. It is also a rapport building, because it's saying, I see you as you come to the table, and I respect and accept you how you come to the table. It doesn't have to be big. It doesn't have to be abundant. It can be small. And for you, that could be so much abundance, right? And in those moments, 9 out of 10 times, that child is like,
wait, you see what?
You saw that?
Yeah.
And now the dance is, do they want you to see that, and do they retreat? Or do they do something more? And in my experience, you could get either or, again, depending on what the trauma is, depending on what the background is. However, that moment still always has an impact. And even if you do not see a progression in that session on that day, it guaranteed in 2 to 3 sessions, you will see that that child responds to that acknowledgement. Now, again, that response may not always be like a positive one, but then that next phase of that relationship is telling you something, because now they're saying, this person is willing to engage me in a conversation no matter where I'm at.
Right. And it's right? like testing it out. Okay. Like maybe it is 3 weeks later. It's like, do you still see me?
Yeah, exactly. And then it's like, oh my gosh, you're moving your whole hand instead of just one finger.
Yeah. I remember
that's so cool.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, and so now they're saying, like, especially, I think you're in a school setting, right? Specifically, but not even in a school setting specifically, because you could be seeing a child in private practice. But the reality is, as children are getting older, the expectations for them to have a very structured day, to have a very structured experience, to present themselves in a certain way becomes more vivid. It becomes more valid, right? And so they may find themselves being reprimanded. They may find themselves being told, like, you need to sit still. You need to be this loud. You need to be this quiet. You know, like, there are adults directing how they need to express themselves. So the opportunity to express themselves and still be seen and still be validated and accepted for who they authentically are, even if this is who they authentically are, goes a long way in terms of demonstrating to them, you are safe here, no matter what you share. You are seen here, no matter how small or how big it is, you know? And so I think those are the building blocks to then expand on movement. And as you evolve that relationship and that child, you know, comes out more, or that child may retreat and they may say, I'm telling you, I don't want to be seen, right? And it's like, that's okay. But again, it's a conversation. So what you may start to get from that child, if it's not more movement, may be the sign that's like, just an acknowledgement that I'm not ready to be seen. So, you know, they could be like, here and doing this. And it's like, oh, I saw that you moved your finger.
Yeah.
Oh, I can see that you don't want to be seen today. It's okay. But, you know, maybe join us next time. And so, because that's still language, that's still communication. And so I think in those moments, we still want to see them. We still want to acknowledge the fact that they are not ready to be seen in that way, because it's still saying and reinforcing safety. It's still reinforcing validation, right? And it's still reinforcing that whether you're angry, whether you're sad, I am going to take you and accept you as you are.
Yep. Beautiful. And that's like when you experience, like, I'd say experience trauma, but also just the messages that children get. Like, I see it happening with my own child, who's just under 8 months, and the people who come to interact with them, it's like, oh, like, someone's here, give them a hug, or, right? Yeah. It's like always instructing how to use your body to communicate. And like, this is the right way to communicate with your body. This, if you're not doing it, then you must be upset, or you must be not normal, or, you know, there's always these polarizing messages. And it sounds like really what you're speaking to is whoever you want to be, however you express yourself, as long as it's safe, right? Mm-hmm. That's okay. And in your own time, there's also this, like, right, this, I'm seeing it in a lot of my mom discussion boards of like, my baby's not crawling yet. My baby's not babbling. Like, so there's always this, like, it's okay. Everyone has a different timeline as well.
Yes. Yes. And, you know, I think as parents, like, you're a mom, I have two small children who are 5 and 6 years old. And I did lots of dance therapy with them. One, because they were in daycare at my job. Two, because we dance at home all the time. And so I think as a parent, we're always wanting to make sure we're doing the most, right? We want to make sure that we've, like, dotted every I and crossed every T. So it is realistic or practical to initially go to that place of saying, my baby's not babbling, my daughter's not crawling, you know. But then we also need to reflect and take a step back, you know. And I think you can check in with the experts. Like, for me, when I felt like, oh, they say that your child should have 50 words at this age, and she doesn't have 50 words, and I don't know what to, you know what I mean? And so it's like, as a parent, I want to feel like I'm doing my due diligence. It doesn't hurt to go get an evaluation and have someone say, like, nope, you know what? I think that's fine. Like, she's not really in school, or she's not really engaging with other people, or she's learning another language, and that slows down, you know, the progression of language learning, right? But once she gets in school and she's around those other kids, you should see a progression. And it's like, it's then my responsibility as a parent to say, am I going to continue to hyper-focus on what my child is not doing? Or am I going to say, okay, I can accept that reasoning and rationale. And how do I now engage with my child and be present with my child in this moment for who they are right now?
Right.
You know what I mean? So I think that we all want to be the best we can be, and we want to give our children the support that we think they need or deserve. But how do we also then get to a place where we say, is this investigating about me and validating how I feel or how I think I'm perceived as a parent? Or is it really about being in relationship to my child?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that is the dance and the conversation that we have to have with ourselves and with our children. Because as someone who has two children, their personalities are very different. The things that they do are very different. The things that they enjoy are very different. And so I have to sit in a place of saying, like, I see you regardless. I have one child who, my six-year-old, loves to dance. Brooklyn loves to dance. She, like, you're dancing? I want to dance. She's like me. Like, music comes on. She can't sit still, you know. Whereas my daughter, London, is more like, that's not really my thing. I'm not really into it. But when she's into it, when she's in that space of wanting to dance, when she's in that space of wanting to be expressive, I am all ready for it. You know what I mean? And I love her and accept that that's not her thing. I don't force her to want to dance. I don't force her to want to join us. And if you've ever seen a video of us dancing, London is usually the one where it's like me and Brooklyn are dancing and London is like, how can I be so close to the camera where you can only see my eye and be like super annoying? Because that's her thing.
Right.
You know, and I love her. I love it because that's her thing. And so I think we have to honor children for who they are and where they're at and kind of say, you know, and someone posed this question recently that says, how can we sit in a place of letting our children really be free to explore and free of expression, right? Because it's almost like, oh yeah, sure, you can play with that. But all I'm really thinking about is how much work it's gonna create for me for you to play with that, how present I need to be in that experience with you if I let you play with that or if I let you do that, right? And so I think it's the dance that we go through. And so now when you add trauma to that, or where you, when you add the inserting of different relationships and different perspectives to that, then, you know, it gets a little bit more complicated. And I think that's when we have to take a step back.
That was going to be my next
perspective.
Mm-hmm. I remember being a huge struggle at the league and even on to my next job at the psych hospital, where I continue to work with children, just more so on the older side, is mm-hmm. there always this struggle between my department as creative arts therapist and the, you know, the techs or whatever it's called in each person's place of work, mm-hmm. that, oh, these are behaviors, they need to be rewarded and they need to be punished. Versus like mm-hmm. us as creative arts therapists of like, okay, like this is a behavior, this is a communication. How can we use it to either, you know, help them grow? Well, I mean, either way, mm-hmm. the goal is to help them grow from it, right? Instead mm-hmm. of shutting it down. So I just imagine there's a lot of questions about this of like, but how do you know, like if they're having oppositional behaviors,
mm-hmm.
how do you find that balance between not shutting them down, but helping them learn and grow and again, continuing to modulate through that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a fine dance, because I think we are all human beings and we bring our own biases and our own traumas to the table and to the experience. And I do believe, especially with children who present more aggressive behaviors, that sometimes that's also trauma or conditioning, because in their experience, if they do those things, people leave them. And so they're also sometimes testing the waters to say, if I do this, will you still be here? Because it's part of their safety test. It's part of their trust test to say, how much does this person really love me? How much is this person really invested in me? And how much is this person really interested in creating a safe space for me? And I think the place where people get confused, I think the place where professionals get confused, I think the place where parents can get confused is to misunderstand or misinterpret, I'm here for you no matter how you show up, as not having boundaries. It's important to still have boundaries within the relationship. Mm-hmm. It's important to still say, I love you. I want to create a safe space for you. I want you to be able to express yourself as you are, but it is not okay to kick me. It is not acceptable or okay to spit on me. It is, you know what I mean? And I remember taking a course, the floor time course with Stanley Greenspan before he passed away. And I got to go up and ask a question, you know, and I asked about that. And that was one of the things that, cause I was dealing with a child that had a lot of, you know, aggressive or inappropriate social behaviors. And one of the things that really stood out for me and has always stood out for me all these years is he's like, but you still have to set boundaries and expectations. You still have to make it clear what is acceptable and not acceptable in the relationship. And the reality is there's this fear, I guess, that like, oh, but that will turn them away or that will reject them. But the reality is like any relationship, they will learn to respect you more for that. And it also, And in my experience, those are the children who I find their way back to me. Because it is almost like a reflection to say, if you are setting those boundaries to keep yourself safe, then you will keep me safe.
Mm-hmm. Can you give us an example within a dance therapy session? Obviously, things confidential, where you have kind of had this opportunity to set boundaries and at the same time nurturing the relationship and nurturing their growth.
There's so many stories.
And I think it's probably to say most of the work that you've done with children are in groups.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
And I have, you know, had the fortune of seeing children individually, but mostly it's in groups. And I think that's important to note because I think something to consider is that when you're in a group, you as a facilitator, you have to consider the needs of the whole group. So there are times where you cannot just meet the needs of one child. You know what I mean? You have to consider how your response to that one child is going to impact the whole group. And it also means that safety is even more of a priority because things that I'm willing to explore or consider in a one-to-one individual session, I can't necessarily explore or consider in a group session. So I think that's important to note. But I think a common thing that has come up for me has always been finding that balance of showing or letting children know how they can engage or come in contact with my body. So even the idea of like a child wanting to be seen or a child wanting to connect, but maybe when they're looking to connect with you, like they're jumping on you, they're jumping on your back or they're jumping or they're on your chest or they're just coming up to you and giving you a kiss and not having any boundaries. And one, in our experience, that can sometimes be concerning. Especially if you're new to the relationship with the child and you haven't really built a rapport, there can be a concern of saying like, this child doesn't really know me. Why are they sitting in my lap and hugging me and kissing me and kind of giving me such intimate affection? And so you may have to set a boundary with that. And there could be situations where you do have a rapport and have built a relationship with the child, but they still just approach you in your space, in a physical place, kind of without you seeing it or without you knowing it. you know, and you may have to say in those moments, like, oh, can you ask permission to, you know, get a hug or touch my body or engage with me? And again, I think that's an example where we're also modeling to children that people need to ask your permission to touch your body as well. Right. And so going back to what you said earlier about this idea that we have a tendency like, oh, Uncle John just came over, go give him a hug. You should be curious if that child doesn't want to give Uncle John a hug. It's not to say that anything is wrong with Uncle John. Right. But it is to say that we want children to feel connected to their instincts. And if their instinct in that moment is, that doesn't feel comfortable for me, but we're still forcing the relationship and we're forcing that as the way that they need to connect, we need to be curious about that. Right. And so
bringing back remnants of trauma with that, right? Being forced into a physical interaction that they
exactly
have no control over, feel trapped in. And like, we have to be really mindful of what these tiny little daily things that are
exactly
tiny can be bringing up for them, can be stirring up for them.
Exactly. And so in that moment, we need to consider as caregivers, again, whether it's in a educational or professional relationship or personal, and kind of say, what are other ways that we can teach children to be respectful or to engage and acknowledge someone's presence without it having to be this intimate contact of giving a kiss or giving a hug. Right. And the reality is, like, though those moments are saved for our intimate relationships. So yes, if you're with mommy and daddy, it may be okay to do that. But if you're out in a public space, then it may not be. And depending on what your own relationship was with your parents, depending on your own traumas and who put those traumas on you, that may be even more uncomfortable for you. And so a perfect example with my own children is one day my daughter was talking to the babysitter and she was like, we don't want any food, you know, like yelling at her. And I went into the room. And I said, who are you talking to? And again, that moment from my own training, from my own upbringing, to kind of say, you don't talk to adults like that. And I caught myself and I changed that to say, does she talk to you like that? Because I know she doesn't, right? Does she talk to you like that? No. How do you think it makes her feel? And how do you think you would feel if someone talked to you like that? Because it's more about the relationship. It's more about the respect than it is about you need to respect her because she's an adult. Because we all know that a lot of traumas or atrocities that happen to children happen at the hands of adults. And so we have to retrain our brains and retrain our words to not teach people to respect someone just because they're an adult, but to respect people because they actually give you respect. And I also think that becomes the place where predators can then use that language against you to put you in a place of fear of not speaking up for yourself, right? Oh, well, I'm an adult, so you need to respect me. Okay, well, that's what my parents say. That's what my caregivers say. You respect adults, even if they haven't earned that respect, right? You have to keep this secret between us. If not, I'm going to tell your parents or I'm going to tell the adult. But that adult has reinforced to you that it is not acceptable to talk back to other adults, and it is not acceptable to engage in a certain way. So now you keep that secret. So now you don't feel comfortable sharing an uncomfortable engagement with an adult. And so I think it's important for us to say, what patterns are we leaning into culturally, right? Because our cultural experiences impact how we engage with the adults in our life, impact how we feel we have a voice as children, and then impacts how we bring that into adulthood. And so we have to kind of say, did that really serve me growing up? Did that serve me as an adult? did I have to work even harder when I became an adult to find my voice, especially when it came to engaging with other adults in professional environments? And something I see all the time with interns who are usually young adults, who are usually college students, when they have to facilitate a group or lead a session, they really struggle and they have so much discomfort with having to delegate responsibilities to older staff members.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? They don't know how to do it. It's super uncomfortable for them.
I think that was uncomfortable to me too, as an intern at the league, which is my, I was 22 or no, I don't remember. It was a while ago.
Yeah. But it's one of those things where how does your cultural and your childhood upbringing of how you engage with adults then impact how you're able to find your voice as you're transitioning from being a child into being a young adult, into being a professional, into being the person who's actually supposed to be in charge. You have to work through that, you know, but it comes, you know, and I think that's the dance, right? The dance is, how do you give children freedom of speech? How do you give children autonomy? Let children hold on to their ability to tap into their instincts and tap into, you know, what feels right without like just letting them do whatever they want to do? And how do you find the balance on letting them do that while still having respect?
I think a lot of, I know, like remembering from the days working at the league, especially when you said they have a lot of emotional range. The first thing that popped into my head was room 13. Now, no one else is going to get that. But
yes.
Holy crap. That's not the right word. That was a wild ride.
Yes.
Literally, so we had rooms, separate rooms for dance therapy. And what would ideally happen is that the classroom waits outside of the door, and then they come in and they come to their spot and they settle in. Room 13 was, no, we don't do that. Boom, 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 boom.
Bulldoze.
Banging against the walls, banging into each other. It was so challenging. And I think there's a lot of children who experience trauma who don't even, like, they're so disconnected, and this happens with adults too. They're so disconnected with what their real instincts are. They don't actually know how to regulate, how to modulate. And there's a lot of like, hey, slow down. Hey, stop that. Hey, you know, and literally they don't have the ability to do that. Like, this trauma acts out or acts through them is this hyperactivity. Is this difficulty in concentration, is just not being able to do what's, you know, usually expected of children to do, is like, all right, calm down, quiet down. It's no matter, it took a lot of work to help them to just not be so almost like, I don't know, legs. There's like all legs in a room running around. And so I think a lot of the time we try to tell people, like tell these kids to stop or stop acting out or sit down. And it's like their energy is like this. And then we want them to be like that. And like a huge thing that I remember practicing as a dance therapist in the sessions is like, okay, well, we're going to meet them where they're at. They're coming in hot. They're coming in fast.
Yeah.
And it's not going to work to just tell them to sit down. That's never going to work. Trust me, I tried. I'm sure you've tried. But
yes,
how can we meet them at the speed and the force and the energy that they're at, and then modulate it to a point where, oh, now I can slow down? And the repeated practice of this in dance therapy is, oh, well, now I know how to slow my body down. It might be hard, but I know how to slow down. And I think that also helps the tension that gets created between the kids who are experiencing, have experienced trauma, and the adults who are like, oh my God, I cannot take another session of this, right?
Yes.
And so I think it's also, like I remember a lot of teaching teaching them what it actually feels like in their nervous system, in their body, to find that place and to be able to do that. Some kids just don't have that ability. It's not all behavior. It's
The ability to self-regulate and modulate. And the thing, you know, the thing that comes up that I do a lot when I have a child, when I have a class that's coming in and they're rambunctious, or I have a child that's coming in, they're rambunctious, I have to match their energy. And so if they're coming in like that, you know, in a traditional, we're taught in school, right, too, in a traditional session, you come in and you create the circle and you ground, but maybe grounding for them can't look like, oh, we're going to put on Bill Withers and listen to Lovely Day and Sway. And, you know, for them, it's like, we're coming in, we're going to run. We're going to crash into that wall. We're going to crash into this wall. You know, there has to be a release. There has to be an exertion of the energy. And if you try to muzzle it, it's going to explode. Like when you finally let it out, it's going to explode.
There was often a fear of like, if you let that happen, if you meet them there, then we're reinforcing this behavior.
Mm-hmm. And you're not.
That. And it's, yeah, no,